Now, a story about education, race, politics, and budgets in New Orleans. Louisiana's Republican Governor Bobby Jindal is considering a move to merge two struggling universities there, historically black Southern University at New Orleans and the largely white University of New Orleans. Both schools have seen their enrollments drop in recent years, and their graduation rates are dismal by just about any standard. But the president of the historically black Southern system said he was shocked by the idea to essentially remove one of its three campuses. For more on what the move would mean for the city of New Orleans and for the nationwide network of historically black colleges and universities, we're joined now by Katie Mangan. She's in Austin, Texas, where she is national correspondent for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And first, a bit more context here. When we say very low, dismal graduation rates, what are we talking about?
Well, in the case of Southern University at New Orleans, the most recent rate was 5%. And of course, that's over a 6-year period. Southern University will say that that was at a time when the university was hard hit by Hurricane Katrina. But also they'll point out that at many historically black colleges, the typical student is someone who's older, who's possibly married, working full time, and they may attend college more sporadically and be in and out of college and having to leave for a while to earn money and come back. And also because many of the historically black colleges have fewer financial resources, there is often less money available for scholarships. So students sometimes have to drop out for financial reasons. But even taking that into consideration, I think most schools that have rates as low as Southern University know that they have to do whatever they can to increase them, or their state funding and possibly federal funding is going to be at risk.
And the University of New Orleans, not a historically black college, their rate is not as low as 5%, but it's not that great either.
It's not that great. No, it's, I think, somewhere in the area of 22%.
Now, given the squeeze that most states and localities are facing in their budgets nowadays, I'm trying to put myself in the position of Governor Jindal. You look at two colleges very close to each other, neither one with terribly successful numbers. A nearby community college, I gather, that's bursting at the seams. There's enrollment is way up, and the idea of merging them seems to have a certain attraction. How common is that idea to merge local campuses?
It's becoming increasingly common. And again, in states that are facing financial crises, this is something that lawmakers are increasingly looking to see if there's some ways that they can combine campuses and consolidate. But anytime you start talking about eliminating a historically black college, a lot of people get upset. There's going to be a lot of lobbying to try to block this.
This speaks to a larger issue within the historically black college and university community, which has been struggling to keep up standards and attract talented black students who can now choose Harvard or Stanford over Fisk or Spelman or Howard.
Yes, I think that's right. I think black students have so many more options today than they did back in the 60s or 70s. And as a result, the percentage of black students who are attending historically black colleges has decreased quite a bit. And that, you know, of course, has caused somewhat of a rift within the black community, just sort of looking at what is the overall value of a historically black college and, you know, how can you justify continuing colleges when you have some sort of duplication with other public colleges nearby.
Well, Katie Mangan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Katie Mangan is a national correspondent based in Austin, Texas, for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Transcripts for the stories you hear today are available for free tomorrow when you visit the story page on NPR.org. Listeners like you make this and other programs possible. Thanks for supporting public radio. This is NPR.
The Tucson shootings have many people examining the intensity of our political rhetoric. Do violent metaphors spark violent acts? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg isn't sure, but he says That isn't the point.
Sarah Palin was right. It was irresponsible for people to say that she had anything to do with the Tucson shootings. I'm not sure why she had to bring blood libel and the persecution of the medieval Jews into it, but she certainly could say it was a bum rap. But people kept talking about political rhetoric, even after the facts came out. For some, it was just an opportunity to bash the right. But most people were worried about the continuing potential for violence. In polls, the majority of Americans said that the tone of debate has become so inflammatory that it could push people over the edge. It's hard to prove that connection. There are more threats on politicians on both sides now, but not a lot of people are unhinged enough to actually try to carry out attacks. And once somebody's that far gone, he could be getting his marching orders from anywhere, Fox News, Grand Theft Auto, or the planet Romulus. But these attacks are disturbing even when they can't be directly linked to the language and symbols of political debate. How can you not be brought up short when a congresswoman is shot after she's been targeted on a campaign map with a crosshair? It's the feeling you'd have if you told somebody, oh, drop dead, and then 2 days later he keeled over with a fatal heart attack. Not that you caused it or even wished it, but all of a sudden your words are rumbling with their literal meaning. The Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz famously said that war is the continuation of politics by other means. But to listen to the way we talk, the opposite is true as well. The language of politics is, you should excuse the expression, shot through with martial imagery, with its campaigns, war rooms, battleground states, political bombshells, and attack ads. And that's not to mention the linguistic carnage that pervades our everyday speech, catch flack, take no prisoners, crash and burn. But it takes a violent event like Tucson to make people self-conscious about this language. 9/11 had the same effect. For a few months, we were all monitoring our words for any hint of semantic mayhem. I recall just after the attacks, listening to the San Francisco Giants announcer Mike Kruko describing the replay of a monster homer by Andres Galarraga. Boy, he said, he really hit that one good. Some people argue that purging our speech of all these metaphors would make us kinder, gentler conversationalists. Instead of saying she shot down his arguments, why don't we say she unraveled them or danced them into a corner? That was presumably what Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree had in mind when she urged the Republicans to remove the word killing from the name of what they're calling the Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act. This didn't make a lot of sense to me at first. In that context, the word kill doesn't conjure up any violent images, no more than it does when we talk about killing the lights, a deal, a bottle of scotch, or a couple of hours between flights. In fact, the proliferation of these denatured metaphors is really a tribute to the civilizing process as we sublimate our aggression into more pacific channels. Still, House Speaker John Boehner started to replace job-killing with job-destroying and job-crushing in his remarks. Those weren't exactly nonviolent alternatives, but there's a point to the gesture anyway. Once you start being careful about these dead metaphors, you're apt to be more circumspect about the ones that still have some blood running through their veins. The fact is that we no sooner domesticate one figure of speech than somebody introduces another to evoke a vivid image of combat. When fire away gets tired, you can go to lock and load. And while a crosshair may function much like a target, it isn't so tame that you can use it as the symbol of a discount store. For that matter, there's a difference between telling supporters at a fundraiser not to be outgunned and telling them, if they bring a knife, you bring a gun. The message doesn't change, but the adrenaline level does. It's a strength of the modern political culture that these apocalyptic metaphors no longer rouse people to armed insurrection. But then indignation has never had so many recreational outlets before. We can spend all our waking hours listening to broadcast political invective or writing sarcastic blog comments to excoriate the morons on the other side. That's the dirty little secret of political vituperation. Left and right, we all like to go there. But even if these violent reveries are almost never acted out, they coarsen the debate and dehumanize the other side. In fact, the scenarios behind those fantasies go a long way toward creating the so-called climate of hate. If you're going to imagine yourself riding to the rescue of the Republic, you're going to need to see your opponents as nefarious alien life forms. You put on a cowboy suit, and suddenly everybody else is an Indian.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. You can follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.